This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Wendy's Big Show served up hot and fresh here on The Fan. Steve Sparky Pfeiffer, former Packer and Badger running back Gary Ellerson, Leroy Butler out for the remainder of the show. Had some stuff he had to get to, so he'll be back tomorrow on The Wendy's Big Show at 2 o'clock. Executive producer Dan Plucker, other side of the glass, joining us now on the Great Midwest Bank Hotline. He, of course, is the Pro Football Hall of Fame lineman for your Green Bay Packers, Dave Robinson. Dave, thanks a lot for coming on, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Enjoy it. How you doing?
Doing pretty good. You know, it's interesting. Our executive producer, Dan Plucker, here, we were trying to figure out, you know, guests for the week and who we wanted to get on and so forth. And he threw out to Gary and myself and Leroy to get you on. He thought you would be a great guest to get on because so many times you've talked about what it was like race relations-wise playing back for the Green Bay Packers with Vince Lombardi and so forth. How Lombardi handled things. For those that haven't heard you in the past, can you just educate everybody of what it was like playing back in the day for Vince Lombardi?
Well, playing back in the day for Vince Lombardi was pretty good because Vince was racially sensitive. Having been an Italian growing up in New York during the time before Italians were accepted, and so he had been ostracized quite a few times. In fact, there were two or three times, another two for sure, in his history that he thought for sure he was going to be a head coach, and something always came up and he didn't get the job. And in fact, right at the end, he thought that when he was in New York, he was an offensive coordinator for that 1957 New York Giant team, which had the overtime game with the Baltimore Colts. And he knew that Jim Lee Howe, the head coach, was getting ready to retire. And Vince thought he was high on the list to get the job as coach of the New York Giants. And that was his hometown, by the way. His family lived in Queens, New York. And then he was told by Wellington Morris that the best thing you could do is take that job offer in Green Bay, Wisconsin, because New York City's not ready for an Italian head coach right now. And because of the racial bias at the time, that's how he came to Green Bay. And, of course, the rest is all history. He turned around. First year, he took a 1-10-1 team. The first year, he was 7-5, which was great. The second year, he won the division, and went to the championship game and lost in the last 2 minutes. And the third year, he took that 1-10-1 team and won the World Championship 37-0. So that was how it was. So, but even more so than that, so playing with Vince was very good. He drafted me in the first round, which was very uncommon in 63 to draft a black person in the first round. And he had drafted Herb Adderley in the first round in 61. And so the rumors were that he had been questioned by the board of directors of people in town, why are you wasting draft choices and drafting black guys in the first round? Because no one's going to touch them until the third round. And the body reportedly said, I don't draft by color here in Green Bay. Only colors we got in Green Bay are green and gold. I draft by blocking, can you block and tackle? And that's what I'm going to do. So you guys control the finances, and I'm going to run this team my way. And that's it. So playing in Green Bay was an ideal place to play. The only problem you had was when you left town. And when you left town, especially in the early years, during the preseason, we had what they call the exhibition games where you went down south and all around the country, putting pro football on exhibit for people so they could see if they could win a pro team in their hometown. And we went south. That segregation and Jim Crow raised his ugly head, and we had to put up with it. And that's all there was to it. Vince tried his best to suppress it, but he couldn't suppress it all. I remember when we went to New Orleans, for instance, one time, and we pulled up to the bus, and all the white guys went in and checked in, and we unloaded our bags on the sidewalk and had to wait until a cab from the other side of town came over to pick us up to take us to the black hotel, because no cab driver would give us a ride in New Orleans. Had to wait for the black cab driver to come all the way across town to pick us up.
That's crazy.
It was wild, yeah. So,
I thought though that day that though Vince also, and of course we're talking race relations because of everything that's going on though, but I thought also that Vince though wanted all you guys to stay in the hotel together. And I think didn't he mandate that you guys stay in the hotel together?
After that, Vince went to great efforts to make sure we did. In fact, we went back to New Orleans. We had to stay way up by the airport. I don't know why, but out there we could live together. And maybe nobody wanted to live up there, to stay in the hotel, because all day long the big jets flew over carrying, kept hearing the landing. But we were at that, we did all sorts of things. But he tried his best. In fact, he made it mandatory that we all stay together. And he was the guy. All the African Americans on the team were upset and embarrassed by it, but. I think Vince was more embarrassed than we were, because he said that was it. No more of that. Yeah.
I want to talk
New Orleans was the Orleans was south. We did play later in New Orleans, and we were in separate hotels. We played a preseason game again, and we played against St. Louis, and I think that was 64, and we stayed in the black hotel in New Orleans. And so did the Cardinals. They stayed down there at the same hotel we were, all the black players of the Cardinals team. It was kind of interesting, made for a very interesting situation. Well, we'll go into that. Yeah.
Well, let me talk about a little bit about too, Dave.
Yes.
I went to a predominantly all-black high school, okay?
Right.
And we were recruited by a number of schools, but decided to come to Wisconsin. And when I came to Wisconsin, I had never seen that many white people before in my life when I got to Wisconsin, right? I'm just being honest. But we got on a football team together. And my roommate was a guy by the name of Bob Bishop, who had went to Thomas More High School here in Milwaukee. It's a private school. And our head coach, Dave McClain, what he would do is, he would bring the black players in, and right away we go to training camp. He roomed the black players with the white players with black players. I mean, not that you weren't allowed to room with the black player, but all the new guys had to room with the white player. And he said, you guys figured out, get to know one another. And I think that was my first real initial issue in that this is how we're going to win. This is how we're going to be a team, and this is how we're going to be able to get along. And I think a lot of people who really haven't played sports in that way don't understand on how you assemble a team and how you can come together as one.
Yeah. Well, it's a little different time, you know. Number one, most of the black athletes were recruited when I came out of high school in 1959. What happened, a common thing, well, first of all, the South was all segregated, and so you couldn't go to the Southern schools, the big Southern schools. And the Northern schools had a limited number of African-Americans on their team. And what would happen, the common thing was, your father, or you would have to pay for your first semester at a college. And then you could get there as a freshman. And then at the end of your freshman football season, they had spring training. You go for spring practice. If you show potential, then they would award you another one-year scholarship, or maybe a 3.5-year, whatever, depending on how good you were. In fact, the great Jim Brown, that's how he got to Syracuse. He wasn't drafted, and an alumni wanted him to go to Syracuse because he was a great lacrosse player. And Jim didn't have the money, and so he paid for Jim's first year in school, semester. And not the whole year, just the semester. And then in spring training, Jim ran over everybody, And so Syracuse gave him a scholarship for the next 3.5 years. And that was it. And I myself, I was never recruited as a football player. They had me on the radar, but no one saw me. And the first time I saw anybody from Penn State came to look at me play in high school, it was during basketball season when I was playing basketball. And they came out to see my athleticism playing basketball and whatnot. And based on that, they awarded me I found out later, I thought it was a 4-year scholarship, but it was only a 1-year scholarship. And but then that spring ball, I looked fairly decent, and they gave me another one. I actually had 3 or 4 1-year scholarships when I was in college. I could have lost my scholarship any year, and I never knew it. But that's how it was. But now when I went to Penn State, I was a playing in, and the other in was white, and so of course because we had the same position, we were roommates. We didn't room. Color wouldn't take into consideration at Penn State at that time. It was you just put your room with a guy in your position so you could discuss the game the night before the game, and that was it. And as we got, and so we had mostly. In fact, I'm trying to think. I can't think of a situation where we had all 2 black guys in the same roommate. But when a couple of most a lot of those years on the traveling squad, we only had 2 or 3 black guys, you know. So
right.
That was different. A lot different. There wasn't a lot of black guys on the team. I'll put it that way. It was a whole different. It was a whole different world. And you lived it. You know, I'll tell you one. This is one thing. You know, I used to do a lot of lecturing during the Black History Month. I noticed the way the country has evolved. No one really cares that much about Black history. And some of the youngsters think that Black history started in with Martin Luther King or something like that. And they don't understand what it's all about. You know, I come from New Jersey, one of the most liberal states in the Union. But when I went to kindergarten, it's first grade, New Jersey, my schools were segregated. I went to all Black school in New Jersey for kindergarten to first grade. And not to second grade did they change the Constitution and force the integration of all the schools and outlawed all kinds of Jim Crow and the racial discrimination in the state of New Jersey. That's 1948, long before the nation woke up. But what did it to New Jersey? Real quick, I'll try to make this quick. New Jersey, where I live, I live 12 miles from Fort Dix, a huge military base. When we captured soldiers, German soldiers, prisoners of war, we shipped them back to the States and housed them in New Jersey at Fort Dix. And if you were on the honor system at Fort Dix, the soldiers got to leave the internment during the day, and they had to come back like 5 o'clock at night and be incarcerated. But anyway, when the war ended, a lot of them didn't want to go back to Germany because Germany was destroyed. And so they asked for one a grand asylum in the United States. And in 1944, 1945, ex-German soldiers who were prisoners of war could go into restaurants and bars, certain ones, in New Jersey, and the black returning soldiers were not admitted. Well, the citizenry in New Jersey, white, black, and everybody else, were enraged by it. And the legislature had to do something. They changed our Constitution immediately. And if it had not for the war, I don't know how long it would have taken them to change it. They just said, okay, this is crazy. No one can bar anybody from coming into the stores or restaurants or any bars or anything. And that's how New Jersey integrated. It's kind of an interesting situation.
Talking with Dave Robinson, Pro Football Hall of Fame, a Green Bay Packers lineman, here on The Fan.
Dave, so I'm sure you've seen and lived in what we're going through right now. Have you seen anything like this before?
Yes, I lived through the assassination of Martin Luther King and even Bobby Kennedy the same year and everything, but the one thing you got to remember, what's going through town. I know Milwaukee's getting to it pretty bad. We had some demonstrations here in Akron, Ohio. You got to remember to separate the protesters from the looters. They're not the same. And I saw George Lloyd's brother had a great impassioned speech. I thought on TV the other day where he talked to he begged the people to remember his brother, not to remember him. In that way, he's a man of peace and wanted to be peaceful. And then he got down on his knees and at the very spot where his brother died and prayed, and some, a lot of people joined him in prayer. And this is how they are. This is how the protesters are doing. They are really protesting something. They're protesting this man's inhumanity to man, how these cops have done to the black citizenry, what they did. They're trying to protest what Kaepernick did, what they've been doing, a nonviolent demonstration by taking the knee, although it was twisted. So all of a sudden, people try to turn it into not a protest against police brutality, but rather it was a protest against our flag, which he never intended. And so it was just wild. But these things show that what he did was something that had to be done. This police brutality is getting outrageous. I saw there were examples of people who were like, I'm just making this up, but let's say a guy is a policeman in the DP here, and he has a lot of trouble with his relationships, and they fire him. And then the same policeman will apply and be accepted in the Green Bay. This is a hypothetical, of course, now. And this happens all the time. These people will hire ex-policemen who were fired from another precinct. And it asks you for trouble. This guy that killed a George Floyd, he in his 10 years, he had something like 18 different citations where people had questioned what he was doing, and he never got indicted. And this guy's a loose cannon on his way, and yet he was there and protected. The prosecutor didn't prosecute the cases. He never did anything. And I think then these guys think that the vast majority of police are not that way, are not bad. But the bad ones know that, hey, we're protected. I can do what I want. My brothers in blue are not going to squeal on me. They're not going to stop me. And if someone does have, takes me to court, I'm going to be exonerated. In Cleveland, the boy was a 12-year-old boy, was sitting there in the playground playing with a plastic gun. Someone called 911 and said there's a boy on the playground playing with, I think it might be a toy gun. She passed on to the police, and the police drove up, and within 12 seconds of getting there, before they had a chance to even question the boy, he was shot and killed. 12-year-old boy was shot and killed by the police. And they were exonerated. They went to court and got off. And so the prosecutors, if you watch Law and Order, the prosecutors and the police work very close with each other. And the prosecutors will not want not to prosecute the policemen. And then when they get in the court, they control the grand juries, so they're not indicted. And so these bad cops, and that's a few of them, but these bad cops know that they're protected. They know if they do something wrong, the brother cops, they got the code, the blue code, where brother cops won't tell on them. They won't stop them. And this is what the situation happened, I think, with George Floyd. He saw the other guy just stand by. And then later things, I saw they were actually helping him hold the man down. And this is terrible. And then what really got me is when they bragged it, they said, hey, Minneapolis is one of the states where we had a cop and we had prosecuted him. He's in jail right now. What they didn't say was, of all the cop shooting incidents in Minnesota, the one where they arrested a cop and he went to jail was when a black cop shot a white woman. All the white people who shot black cops got off, shot black people, excuse me. But when a black cop shot somebody, he was prosecuted and sentenced, I think it's 10 to 15 years in jail for second degree murder, whatever it was. And so, they were bragging that they were very biased, just because they had a policeman in jail. Yeah, that just showed more to me, the way I saw it. That was the worst thing he could have done. They're saying that, yeah, we're going to prosecute any black cops who do something wrong, but white cops can do whatever they want to. And this has got to be, I think the way that these cops are trained, the training's got to be changed, and the city and the state's got to, or the city's got to be more conscious of who they're hiring and why they're hiring, what kind of record he's got. If he was fired by another precinct, another district or something, then why would we want to touch him, you know? And if he does get with us and we don't, if somebody does something, why do we want his partners, why do we want to let the other policeman out of his blue code and not get on him? You know, Gary, if you and I went and robbed a bank right now, and you were outside in the car, and I went inside the car, and I robbed the bank, and on the way out, I shot somebody and killed a man doing it, committed that felony, and you were just driving a car, you'd be sentenced, you'd be tried as for murder, as well as I.
Correct.
We'd both be up for murder, because we both were involved in a felony in which somebody was killed or died. But yet, cops all the time, one cop, there was the four cops there. One of them is now, they have arrest for third degree murder charge, which I think was ludicrous. And the other three, nothing's been done to them. And if it had been a different situation with just guys in the street, all four would have been charged because they did nothing. You can't participate or be involved in a felony with somebody else that you don't get charged as a felony, except if you're a policeman. And then the prosecutor, he said take, because of the autopsy, it has one thing, and he just state that the man was, he was taken to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. And I've heard on some people on the radio talk saying, well, he died in the hospital. No, he didn't die in the hospital. He died on the street. They took a corpse to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. But but people in their minds want to try and protect the police, would justify what they did, say, well, he died in the hospital. The autopsy that he came up with said that he died because of heart issues. No. When they had the family had their own autopsy done, and so the county did an autopsy, and they said he was strangled, and for lack of oxygen, his heart stopped beating. And so they're saying he died of a heart attack. If that's the case, everybody that dies of a heart attack, because for some reason or another, the heart stops beating. But yeah, they did, and it's just ludicrous that they would think that they can pull the wool over their eyes. And why would a prosecutor want to issue a statement that was so controversial and confusing that he died because his heart stopped beating? You know, it's crazy. And these are different things that got to be changed. I don't think that if a policeman is charged, that his prosecutor in his district should be the one to prosecute the case. Should be done by a state attorney general or something, to state attorney or somebody who's not in the same mix. It's got to be done. I'm not that astute in the different rules, but I just know it's got to be changed. Something's got to be changed to where, when a cop does something, he's going to have to be responsible for his actions. And if you sit there and watch somebody do something or a party to it, you also got to be a part, found guilty, and you've got to be held up for what you do. It's got to be something. And until that happens, you're going to see these things over and over again, and you're going to see the protests. Now, unfortunately, somebody was sitting there waiting. And I'm of the belief that, like a lot of people, that there's two groups there. There are protesters and there's looters. And the looters are just waiting. They saw the protest thing. This is our chance to get things. And they are breaking and burning buildings. And as George Floyd's brother said, why are you guys burning down our community? Why are you destroying our shops? There were a lot of, they destroyed some shops that were owned by African-American owners, small businesses. And there's one lady was saying she was burnt out and she couldn't know how she was going to rebuild. She didn't have the money. She's out of business now. She had a whole life. All her life savings were in that building. And they burned it out, destroyed it. So the looting and the protests are different. And it bothers me a lot when they keep saying the protesters looted. No. There's two distinct groups, if people go behind in the here in Ohio, they had the protest movement in Cleveland, but they bust up from Columbus. Now this is not just people coming out to protest. Somebody had to organize the buses, had to organize the whole thing, and get the people in the bus to bring them to Cleveland, and blah blah blah. This sounds like some kind of a controlled situation where people have done it. just for the sake of trying to loot.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. No doubt about it. Dave, hey, man, thanks so much for coming on. Dave Robinson, Pro Football.
I'm sorry to run off the mouth. I do this, man.
Hey, man. It's all good, man.
That's a very sensitive subject of mine. Yeah.
And that's why we wanted to get you on. We thought you'd be good, and you were. Pro Football Hall of Fame Packers lineman. Dave, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, buddy.
My pleasure. Yeah, thank you, man. Listen, tell Lamar I said hello to him for it, please.
I will. Okay. He had to go take care of the kids.
That's number one. That's him first.
That's right.
Yes, sir.
Right. Take care. Hey,
thank you, John. I enjoyed the platform. Thank you very much.
You betcha. Dave Robinson, again, Pro Football Hall of Fame Packers lineman here on the Great Midwest Bank Hotline. Has your passion outgrown your home? A Great Midwest Bank home renovation loan may give you the space it deserves. Visit greatmidwestbank.com today. Simply local lending since 1935. Gary Ellerson, there is only one place to go buy your jewelry.
Well, there is, and that's my good friends over at the Jewelry Center, 76 and Layton Plaza in Brookfield, off of Blue Mountain Road and Tri-City National Bank Building right there on the corner, and a third location for you folks in Burlington, Wisconsin. Guys, they have opened their shop. They're ready to go. They're ready to help you guys, and their stores to shop, their full-service repair center is ready for all your jewelry and watch repair needs. The Jewelry Center hours, guys, Tuesday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Burlington location closes at 5:30 p.m. weekdays and at 2 p.m. on Saturdays. Learn more about us, our three locations, the brands we carry, and our full-service repair department at shoptjc.com.
Some news here before we get to CBS News. This coming out from Mayor Barrett, says, quote, last night we saw a noticeable reduction in illegal activity associated with public protests. I'm optimistic that reduction will continue this evening. At this time, I am not ordering a curfew for tonight, Tuesday, June 2nd. However, if conditions warrant, says Mayor Barrett, I will on short notice institute a citywide curfew. I want to thank all the public safety officials who have been working tirelessly to protect our city. I have respect for the thousands of Milwaukee residents who have peacefully demonstrated in recent days, and I hope that all future protests are lawful, end quote. That the statement from Mayor Barrett concerning tonight. So, no curfew tonight for the city of Milwaukee. Gary Ellerson, your thoughts?
Well, let's just see what happens. I mean, I'm interested to see how this shakes out. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, they've done some damage, but they really hadn't done a whole heck of a lot. So let's see what they do with this.
All right, let's get the latest on what's going on around the country with CBS News.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.